thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's December 2022, and this is episode 318, which is a conversation about the Disney Plus Star Wars series, Andor. Today's guest is Cole Burgett, who is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. Cole teaches classes in systematic theology and Bible exposition, and he also writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an online exclusive television series review for the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called An Occasion for Just War. Subscribers can read his review article about Andor for free on our website, equip.org. For those who would like to read the review and don't already subscribe, please head on over to equip.org to subscribe for $33.50. Cole, it's good to have you on again.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
As I mentioned, today we're talking about the brand new Disney Plus series that's based on the Star Wars universe. It's called Andor, and it just finished its streaming first season. And it has been met with kind of a critical acclaim. And so we want to talk about it because it's a little bit different than most people's exposure to Star Wars, unless you're a major fan and deep into the Star Wars universe and lore. So this is taking a character from the actual in-theater film Rogue One and showing time before the actual start of the Rogue One film, which is the film that is in the Star Wars timeline right before the original Star Wars in 1977, as far as where it falls into the timeline with the Death Star and everybody, things that people are familiar with. But there's probably some listeners that, you know, aren't necessarily into sci-fi, aren't big Star Wars fans. As a matter of fact, I know some students that are friends of my oldest son, and you know, they're Gen Z and they've never seen Star Wars in their life. So it could be a lot of different people who haven't seen Star Wars. So can you give us an introduction to the series of Andor and how it fits in the timeline that I've just referenced briefly in Star Wars? And then I want to ask you too, if you could include some thoughts about why there are no Jedi in this series, because one thing that even people who don't watch Star Wars know about is I think there's something called lightsabers and Jedi. So at least in pop culture, people are familiar with those kinds of characters.
Yeah, so Andor is set in the years between Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, and the original 1977 Star Wars, now known as Episode 4, A New Hope. The series tells us it begins in 5BBY, which is a dating system used in the Star Wars universe that stands for Before the Battle of Yavin, the battle that occurs during the climax of the original film where Luke destroys the Death Star. So Andor picks up about 5 years before the original film and follows the character of Cassian Andor, played by Diego Luna. This character was first introduced to audiences back in the 2016 film Rogue One, and the events of that film lead directly into the events of the original Star Wars, as you mentioned. So Andor is about exploring the life of this character before the events of Rogue One and showing just how it is he came to occupy such an important position within the Rebel Alliance when that film begins. Now, to your question about why there are no Jedi, because that tends to be what people associate with Star Wars and the lightsabers and the swashbuckling sword fights and stuff like that. Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, shows the fall of the Jedi, the collapse of the Jedi. And when you get to Episode 4, A New Hope, which is set 19 years later, the Jedi are all but extinct, and Luke Skywalker is put on the path of becoming the New Hope, the titular New Hope. And so when we get into Andor and Rogue One and that era, there are very few Jedi left in the galaxy. Yoda is on Dagobah, Obi-Wan is on Tatooine, but by and large, the Jedi have been wiped out. So you're looking at a story that takes place about 15 years after the last of the Jedi were destroyed. And one of the things we've talked about before is in the context of Star Wars, when the Republic falls, or I guess right when the Clone Wars started, because the Clone Wars took a large number of them, there were only about 10,000 Jedi in the broader Star Wars galaxy. And because the stories are so focused on them, general audiences can tend to forget that and think that that's all that is in Star Wars. But as you're beginning to see with series like Andor and Rogue One, that the Jedi are actually a very, very small part of the much larger galaxy. They're sort of mythical figures in their own right. The likelihood of someone meeting a Jedi in their lifetime is slim to none. And then after their decline and their fall, they're all but wiped out. There's you know, less than 100 of them left. So in the broad grand scheme of things, you're not going to really see Jedi even mentioned, which is the case with Andor.
I want to let our listeners know that because Star Wars just has such a big imprint on pop culture, we have covered it in various different cultural apologetics material at the Christian Research Journal. So you might want to head on over to our website. We have a really in-depth feature article called Evaluating the Star Wars Worldview by Robert Velarde. We have covered the series The Last Jedi, which was just mentioned, as well as the series The Mandalorian and Boba Fett, and the recent one, Obi-Wan Kenobi. So you will be able to listen to podcasts and read articles about those particular slivers of Star Wars content that we have on our website. But I want to just ask you a little bit, because Andor seems to me to be very different than typical Star Wars that we've covered in the past. And that is, Star Wars seems to be a very kid-friendly series. I mean, including all of the, you know, marketing and different toy products and everything like that. It's always seemed to capture the imagination of kids. And especially even in the film, the much maligned film, I will say, by certain Star Wars fans, The Last Jedi, you have the ending scene of little kids looking to the stars to think that they might be the next person who has powers of the Force to, you know, help the universe for good. So it's been very much appealing to children and that kind of age group, even though adults have really latched onto Star Wars and love it for sure. And of course, in turn, as they've had kids, introduce them. But Andor to me seems very mature. It's gritty. It is dark in certain ways, and it's very philosophical to me. For example, I was taking some note of some dialogue that was said by various characters, and I will tell you, as someone who's not super into the lore but a lifelong Star Wars fan, these are not lines that George Lucas would have written. So one of them in the series was, "Oppression is the mask of fear." That's not really a quotable line for children. And then another one that stood out to me was, "I burn my decency for someone else's future." Those are very heavy just statements right there. There's so much meaning packed in there philosophically. So could you tell us a little bit how different this series is from one of the ones that I've mentioned that we have covered in the journal, and that's The Mandalorian. And of course, you covered also for us the Kenobi series. And is this a series, even though it's on the Disney Channel, is this a series that has themes that might be too mature for younger kids?
Yeah. Andor is a different flavor of Star Wars show from anything that has come before. You can kind of see this progression looking back at the television shows of more mature and intelligent stories being told, from The Mandalorian to The Book of Boba Fett, and especially with parts of Obi-Wan Kenobi. But Andor is a different beast altogether, and it shows even visually. This is the first of the Star Wars series that prioritizes practical effects and set building, for example, over the screen technologies that The Mandalorian pioneered and the other shows have used. And it just goes to show that there is no substitute for patient but expensive practical filmmaking techniques, because the first 5 minutes of Andor look better than anything else Lucasfilm has done with these TV shows. But the differences are not just in themes and visuals. Andor is hands down the most intelligent Star Wars television series to date. The show was created by Oscar-nominated writer-director Tony Gilroy, who wrote and directed 2007's Michael Clayton, which is honestly in my top three films ever made. I think it is an absolutely brilliant film and probably the last film Hollywood ever made for adults. And he also worked on Rogue One. So it's fitting that he's here for Andor. And his creative team consists of writers who worked on critically acclaimed shows like The Americans and House of Cards, and those influences certainly show. It might not be the most obvious stable for writing a Star Wars series, but it's probably the unexpectedness of that which lends the show its greatness. It is very reminiscent in some ways of Ron Moore's reimagined Battlestar Galactica series. And you see the maturity, as you note, in the dialogue especially. Characters here just do not talk like Star Wars characters. And what I mean by that is that George Lucas certainly had a way with dialogue, and not always good. Even the cast, like Mark Hamill, have talked about that, and Harrison Ford have talked about that. But it is very memorable in places. The characters, as Lucas wrote them, say these very self-aware things, like, I've got a bad feeling about this. The dialogue here is different. Characters say things like, I burn my decency for someone else's future, which is a line that Lucas could not have written on his best day with two cups of coffee and an epiphany. And I like George Lucas. I really, really do. I'll defend the guy till the bitter end. The dialogue is just different, and there are lots of standout lines from lengthy monologues as well. So everything from the visual style to the dialogue has been reworked for Andor, and for the first time, it feels as though there is a creative team that is trying to do something truly unique and different with Star Wars. A team that isn't just trying to imitate George Lucas or recapture the magic of those original films. And that is a double-edged sword, because Lucas has always maintained that Star Wars is for kids, as you've talked about. So in some respects, is this a situation where the further you get from the idea, then are you really making Star Wars, or are you doing something else entirely? And that's an area that can be debated. I'm more of the camp that Star Wars, at least with regards to the films, is meant for kids. The films are generational stories, and they have a kind of baseline black and white morality that is rooted in mythic storytelling. But Andor is absolutely interested in complicating that. However, nothing is being complicated using the films or the major characters that Lucas created. Andor is just a very different, very mature take on Star Wars, and I don't think kids would do very well with it. It's not that there's anything necessarily risque, but there's a lot of death, sometimes very shocking and very unexpected deaths of characters that viewers might have grown attached to. And it's not that the show revels in that, but it's meant to show the cost of this rebellion. It's meant to show the sacrifices that characters are willing to make for a better tomorrow. And it isn't always pretty. All that to say, I would just caution anyone who wants to show a young child this series just because it has the word Star Wars attached to it. Kids, especially younger kids, are not going to be able to grasp many of the themes at play here or even the dialogue. This is definitely hard PG-13 material.
The Christmas season is upon us, and really a wonderful, thoughtful gift for your Christian friends and family would be a gift subscription to the Christian Research Journal, because it's a gift that keeps on giving, as they say, throughout the entire year, because your gift recipient will receive access to all of our exclusive online articles that are just for our subscribers. Plus, they'll get the print edition to their door. And it just makes a really thoughtful gift also for maybe your pastor or the discipleship minister at your church. It would just be really great because, as I said before, sometimes pastoral staff members and church staff members don't have time to research the latest theological trend that's going around or teacher that's popping up, and people want to know, is their teaching biblical? So the Christian Research Journal is just a great resource for that. Plus, you can tell them about this podcast because it's a weekly, thoughtful, theological deep dive into a subject, and it's completely free, and they can subscribe to it on their favorite podcast stream. So I'd really consider giving a gift subscription, which you can do at our website, equip.org. And also, I know that really a good way to help us out if you're already done with your Christmas shopping would be to please give us a rating or review. And basically, Apple Podcasts is the best place to do that. So if you go on over there and give us a starred review, that'll literally take seconds. But we would really love for you to give a short sentence about why you listen to this podcast. Because as I've said before, it helps us with the algorithm. Plus, people know, well, what this podcast is about, and maybe they would be interested in listening to it. And if you're like me, online reviews make all the difference. If it's for your favorite restaurant or movie or whatever it is, fill in the blank. People want to know, is this something I would like? And so having those reviews up there really helps people know, hey, I want to try this out. So thank you for considering giving a gift subscription to the Christian Research Journal this year. Well, before we get into the actual content of Andor and its themes, I always ask this because we usually have a lot of new listeners listening to the podcast. So is there anything of value here for the Christian? And, you know, we've talked before when you have done some stuff for us on Star Wars, and we've talked about Star Wars, we've talked about myth and why myth is important to pay attention to for the Christian. And this is, you know, a little bit more complex and mature, as you were just saying. So it's not like the traditional black and white morality of Star Wars. Like, we know who the good guys are and the bad guys are. Like, there's Darth Vader, and he's marching down the hall to scary music in all black. So we know he's bad. And, you know, there's Luke Skywalker, and he's trying to, you know, save the universe or whatever. But is there anything a Christian should be aware of when they're watching Andor? Because I find, as I watch it, and I really enjoyed it, again, it is different, like we talked about, but it seems very morally ambiguous, even among the, quote, good guys.
Yeah, I don't know that there's anything Christians should be extremely wary of. There is a couple in the series that are heavily implied to be a homosexual couple, but the show is not preachy about it in the way many Christians fear these kinds of things to be. Maybe there was a moment or two that I missed, but it's the kind of relationship that could also be read as a close friendship in most places, I think. Beyond that, it's really just the tone of the whole thing that you have to think about. Again, Star Wars has always been a pretty safe bet when it comes to clean entertainment. But Andor is doing something different that is quite dark in places. You don't want your 8-year-old dressing up as Cassian Andor for Halloween once you've seen this series. Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, sure. But Cassian is a different kind of character altogether. He has that really shocking introduction in Rogue One, where in his very first scene, he shoots an ally in the back to prevent them from being captured by the Empire. And this series really does a good job of bringing out that facet of his character. Here you have a guy who is willing to make the hard decisions, who understands the cost of war, and that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. This series explores what gets him to that point, what hardens him into the kind of man who would kill his own ally if it means preserving the rebellion. So I think if you're looking at the series and expecting it to be this traditional good versus evil story, where all the good guys wear white hats and all the bad guys wear black hats, you should temper those expectations considerably. And that's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, sure. But to miss Andor is to miss, honestly, some of the best storytelling that Star Wars has ever done. And there is a lot to be interacted with here in terms of morality and ethics and different, even competing philosophies, as you mentioned. That being said, there are probably certain groups that would have a hard time with some of the ideas floating around in Andor, which is not a pacifist-friendly show. Adventists come to mind. And that's one of the biggest ways this series is different from the rest of Star Wars, which really is a, kind of a fairly pacifistic property. But this series sort of pulls no punches, in a way condemning people who a lot of the rebels see it as standing on the sidelines and not taking action. So that's just stuff to be aware of when you go into the show.
You know, we're talking about how it's different than most of the Star Wars properties that people are familiar with, or at least the films, the first nine films. But one of those ways in which it's different is it's a very political show. In other words, it brings up various issues that usually result out of things like government power or just the nature of war. We're going to talk about that for a chunk of the podcast. You know, how should Christians view war? This is, like you said, interesting conversations can be had from the series watching it. So in some ways, you know, Star Wars also has been political. We see that there's different, you know, the Empire is a ruling entity. And, you know, they talk about senators, they have the Senate, and they have these thousands of senators from all these different planets. So it's always had those elements, political elements to it. But Andor really, it seems to me, puts the politics of the galaxy kind of in the front and center of the action. So can you explain a little bit about the politics of Star Wars and how Andor, you know, gives us a very different look at this side of the conflict? You know, we're going to talk about war between the rebels and the Empire. And it's really interesting to me, even you were talking about some production things that are different. And how I see it is normally, you know, I remember from the prequel films, you went to Coruscant and it was this beautiful, shiny, glittering place and it was bustling and clean. And this Coruscant is a little bit dark and a little bit like, not spooky, but there's just the sense of not everybody is honest and you might have to watch out for your neighbor because they could be spying on you or reporting on you. It has that kind of almost the vibe of, you know, post-World War II Eastern Europe.
Yeah, it's certainly implied in the series that the Empire is a bit like that Orwellian 1984 future where you're kind of always under surveillance and under watch. But Star Wars, and this is so important for anyone who is considering getting into Star Wars to realize, it has always been kind of political, even under George Lucas, especially the prequels, as you mentioned, which in large part show how liberty and freedom is quite literally handed away. George Lucas himself has talked at length about this in multiple places. Tyranny is often voted into office and democracy is often undone quietly and from within. This is the idea behind Padme's line in Revenge of the Sith, "So this is how liberty dies," with thunderous applause, which might be the most profound line George Lucas ever wrote. Well, Andor is really a show about people waking up to that realization. And without getting too deeply into spoiler territory, the climax of the season involves a fairly rousing monologue delivered by one of the main characters that really sort of condemns indifference and even certain kinds of pacifism in a way. This speech talks about people who are complacent in the galaxy, who let the Empire get by inch after inch because they are indifferent, until they wake up one day and realize that the Empire has taken whole miles, to use that expression. And there is a real sense in which Andor is about the galaxy waking up to that realization and saying no more. And Star Wars has traditionally in the films been this mythic story against which the rebellion has been a key part, but mostly a backdrop, a kind of plot device for fueling the story. But here, the rebellion, as you mentioned, is front and center. Viewers begin to explore the inner workings of the rebellion and the Empire to get a feel for how both operate. And so you not only see the bureaucracy that oftentimes gets in the way of effectiveness in the Empire, but you also get to see the sheer desperation of the many faceless rebels. The main characters of Andor are the people who in the films are those faceless soldiers running around shooting at each other, or the side characters who you see in meetings who have a minute or less of screen time. Andor is interested in putting those people front and center, and in taking viewers into that territory. It ends up putting very real and human faces on the Galactic Civil War and the conflict between the Rebellion and the Empire.
Well, I want to ask you about one of the characters in Andor that is in other Star Wars series that people might not be as familiar with, and that is a senator, a woman who's a senator named Mon Mothma. And unlike some of the other characters in the show, she's, as I said, more iconic. She's been in other things. But here her character is given a little bit more screen time, maybe than people have seen her before. So what is Mon Mothma's role in the whole kind of Coruscant scene in this particular series? And how does her character contrast with the rest of the characters that are focused on in Andor?
Mon Mothma is one of those rare characters in this show who is actually an original series character. She first appeared played by Caroline Blakiston in Return of the Jedi. She's the woman in white who is a major player and leader in the Rebel Alliance. And in Andor, she's played by Genevieve O'Reilly. And this series has a bunch of standout performances. Stellan Skarsgård, as we talked about, gives this fantastic performance. But hers is really one of the best in the show. She takes this character, who began life as almost a cameo appearance in the original trilogy, and now almost 50 years later is fleshing her out and showing just how hard it was for her to fall in with the Rebellion. And what's interesting here is that so much of Andor is about the boots-on-the-ground espionage stuff, the inner workings of the Imperial Security Bureau, and the management of assets by rebel spies. But with Mon Mothma, we get to see the beginnings of the Rebel Alliance from a completely different standpoint. We get to see how these very rich and wealthy senators and power players have to maneuver carefully through these imperial sympathizers in order to do things like move money. As you said, the Coruscant portrayed in Andor is a place of, you know, backstabbers, and you never know whose side of the line someone is going to fall on, and you have to watch yourself carefully and conduct yourself in a different way. But this is one of the biggest assets to Andor, where it sort of takes this very common sense approach to storytelling to explore things that most people would just sort of take for granted in the movies. It would take massive, massive amounts of resources and a huge network just to have, you know, a hidden rebel base, for example. And with Mon Mothma's storyline, viewers begin to get a feel for what it took financially and emotionally to get the Rebellion off the ground under the Empire's nose. So there is a lot of political intrigue and doublespeak that would frankly probably bore kids. This is a facet of the show where characters are literally smiling and laughing in plain sight to mask the fact that their conversations are about sabotage and insurrection. And those kinds of layers, that kind of nuance, is likely going to be lost on younger viewers who just won't quite grasp what's happening. But for older viewers who have a love of the source material, this stuff should prove pretty interesting. And Mon Mothma's story is a nice counterpoint to the rest of the show, which is about these kind of down and dirty spy masters who are trying to pull together this fledgling rebel alliance from all of these partisan groups. But her story is about trying to bankroll that and trying to work a rebellion from within the government itself. It shows just what it took to form the rebellion in the upper echelons.
You know, we're not going to break down each character that's in Andor, but I certainly hope that it was a breakout moment for actor Kyle Soler as a character named Cyril Karn. I mean, he just really is dominant in every scene that he's in, just from a facial expression or something that's like literally you can read in his eyes. He's just an excellent actor, and he's been, you know, acting for many, many years. But I guess this could be, I hope it's going to be a breakout role for him, because he was extremely excellent in portraying this kind of cog in the wheel worker of the Empire and his just absolute devotion to the Empire. And someone, you know, you always like, we're talking about nuances and shades. You know, normally we see the people of the Empire, we think of, okay, those are stormtroopers, or that's Darth Vader. This is the first time we're seeing a character that is loyal to the Empire because they really believe in the cause.
Yeah, he's a true believer in order and structure, which, if you remember in episode 3, is sort of what Palpatine promises the Empire will do to bring order to the galaxy. And this guy is all sold out, as it were, to that idea. But what his character shows is, again, just how the bureaucracy of the Empire, the cog in the wheel, as you said, can get in the way of just effective work. And sort of his arc throughout the series is effectively that he's actually quite good at his job. If the Empire would just turn him loose and let him do what he knows to do, he actually could probably sniff out the rebellion quite quickly and easily. But the issues that he runs into consistently are these sort of imperial power players who are more interested in negotiating their own standing and their own promotions and making sure things don't look too out of line. That's where he finds an ally in one of the other characters. Sort of it's a tenuous alliance, but by the end of the series, you can tell that they're sort of gelling a little more, and she kind of begins to see his worth, that he sort of can turn up in unexpected places, but he's always sort of on the right path when it comes to trying to find the rebels. But his character does a very good job of showing how the Empire would be more effective if it just wasn't trying to be so effective, if that makes sense. So it's the flip side of the coin. His character begins to show the inner workings of the Empire and ultimately the infighting that will come to cripple them much later on, because it's just a bunch of, you know, office workers who are more interested in stabbing this guy in the back so they can get a promotion than in actually maintaining order in the galaxy. And his character really brings that out as a counterpoint to all the rebel activities that are going on in the show.
I think that Andor is very much a show about espionage and just different, you know, political moves that we were talking about, especially with this other character that is prominent within the series, a character named Luthen. You just mentioned the actor Stellan Skarsgård, which I think Stellan Skarsgård in his 70s is having a renaissance, because he's in this show and also he was just masterful in Dune with just a few scenes. But this character of Luthen begins to show, it's not so much what we talked about before. The good guys are very evident, Luke Skywalker, Han Solo kind of thing, Luke and Leia. And then the evil guys, you can tell because it's here comes Darth Vader in his black cape. It's not this kind of very cut and dry morality that usually, again, is presented to kids in more of a kid-friendly kind of content. And in many ways, this series is really thinking through the issues of what does it mean to literally go to war? What does it mean to rise up against a power? And that's just been true since the beginning of time, right? And of course, you know, in the history of the church, the early church wrestled with these kinds of issues. You know, is it just? We've covered just war theory a bunch at the Christian Research Institute in our journal. And what makes for a just war? And, you know, especially Augustine, you know, handled some of these issues. But when Christians come to this series, because we're talking about how different cultural apologetics types of issues come out in particularly in film and books and TV series, but in film and TV series a lot. And this is a really good conversation that a Christian could have with someone who's not religious. So can you explain to us a little bit of the history of just war theory and how Christians have really interacted throughout church history with that idea? When should people go to war? And does the Bible teach us that it's morally okay to go to war?
Sure. So the just war theory is a kind of military doctrine or tradition that deals heavily with the ethics of warfare. It has been a subject of study for quite literally thousands of years, and is something that has developed over time in which Christian thinkers have participated in throughout the centuries. In fact, many Christians have played a huge role in shaping our understanding of what a just war is. A good example of this, and probably the most well-known, would be the writings of the Church Father Augustine. In its most basic definition, the just war theory is concerned with the moral justifiability of war or conflict. What that criteria is specifically is where the ethical debates come in. There are two very broad categories traditionally talked about in Latin terms, but in English we would understand it as one, the right to go to war, and two, right conduct in wartime. And these are pretty self-explanatory. The first category deals with the ethical situations that lead up to going to war, and the second category deals with the ethical situations one encounters in wartime. So this is a really significant area of study for theologians, for ethicists, and policymakers. Historically, church leaders like Augustine, as we've mentioned, have contributed to the discussion, and in the medieval era, Thomas Aquinas furthered it. And biblically, we understand that God has put civil government in part to mediate justice. We see this all throughout the Old Testament, especially, where God uses national entities to exercise his judgment in both direct and indirect senses of that. Christian writers often pick up on that and seek to help shape the just war theory in light of those biblical precedents. Obviously, most agree that violence and war is a last resort, but when all other options are spent and war is the only recourse, then many theologians and ethicists want to have these criteria in place so that war can be waged within the most moral and ethical context possible.
So just war, as we mentioned, you know, is developed over a long period of time, that particular doctrine, I guess, and it's still very much a hotly debated issue, especially within the Christian community, because there are Christian traditions that are pacifist and don't believe in war at all. And I do want to tell our listeners that way back in episode 162, I did a podcast on just war theory and revolutions in terms of, like, how do we look at it when we're looking at the founding fathers of the United States, or, you know, we see different, you know, famous people in the past in history, Mao or Stalin, etc. So if you want to look that one up in the archives, please feel free. And also on our website, we have an article you can read that was published in the Christian Research Journal about jihad and just war theory. Like, how do we look at some of those things when we're talking about, you know, guerrilla warfare in the modern sense, specifically with those who hold to that within Islam? But usually just war theory deals with concerns about war within national powers, although, like I mentioned, we have covered it in other contexts like jihad. But Andor's story is not really about war within a national entity, because the rebellion is just these pockets of folks. And that's part of what's depicted. You see one character who's just there briefly, who is a young man, and he's written a whole manifesto against the empire, and he gives that manifesto to Andor. So there are people who just really believe in the, they keep talking about the cause, And so, you know, it's not this, you know, this country against this country in Andor, and more about just that fuzzy morality of rebellion and civil rest within an established and far-reaching empire that is portrayed as an evil empire. So how does a Christian think about just war theory into this context? And it causes us to think about just war theory in the real world, not just this particular set of myths, but it helps us think about some of these issues. And what's happening here in Andor is more like a revolution and, you know, perhaps an eventual civil war than two different superpowers going to war, for example.
Yeah, so we sort of know from the story that this is kind of where all this ends in this, you know, great civil war. But it's worth pointing out that the just war theory was primarily developed within the context of war between national entities or nation states, as you've touched on. There have been plenty of people who have criticized the theory for not being well-rounded enough. But I think that's just part of the nature of the beast. The face of warfare is something that is constantly changing and evolving due to advancing technologies, for example. And so the criteria is often being refined to accommodate that. But where the doctrine is weak is in discussing revolution or upheaval within an established system. The criteria for going to war is not as strongly defined in the context of rebellion and insurrection against an oppressive regime as it is in the context of war between national entities. And from a Christian standpoint, where the biblical mandate is that we are to submit to the governmental authority that God has instituted, this particular conversation can become complicated quite quickly. And I don't claim to be any sort of final authority on this topic. I think any human today who claims that is probably someone you should run from. But I will say that it becomes increasingly difficult to argue as a Christian for all-out insurrection against a governing authority if that authority has not willingly and obviously abused that authority. And as has happened in Andor, where there are mass killings and blood in the streets, and the Empire is working to cover it up. And I know someone somewhere will sit and say, well, that's fairly easy to say while sitting in a country that was founded on rebellion. But by the same token, a lot of this stuff is just in the warp and woof of reality. Wars happen, rebellions happen, nations rise and nations fall, and every nation probably thinks itself invincible at one point or another. But history proves time and again that every nation, no matter how great, is on the clock. Whether it falls from within or without is another story. But regarding the question of revolution, I think that's one that every Christian interested in entertaining the subject is going to have to wrestle through for themselves. But again, pointing out that biblically, you're going to have to do some pretty fantastic hermeneutical gymnastics to get around the New Testament prerogative to submit to governing authorities. Many Christians were being killed for their faith in the early church, and the last thing Paul encourages them to do is pick up a sword. But that is so tied to his theology, which we often miss. Paul was the guy who would stand up and say, "What's the worst you can do? Kill me? Fine. To live is Christ, to die is gain. You take my head, you're doing me a favor." Because Paul believed in a resurrection. He really believed that death wasn't the end, which is a doctrine I sort of wonder if Christians really buy into in the 21st century. It's that old adage, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Again, not saying I have the answers here for a just war in the context of a revolution, simply saying that there are certain biblical precedents any Christian thinker is going to have to reckon with when developing their own thoughts on this topic.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting just, you know, with current events or just history that people, I don't know if they've really thought that much because we're so far removed from the revolution that started this own, our own country. You know, we don't really see that. And as you said, how do we think about just war, especially with, you know, thinking through things like modern technologies? We actually did, it was quite a few years ago, 7 years ago, we did publish an article about just war and asymmetric warfare in terms of like drones. How do Christians think about that? It's not like, you know, 1776 with your musket on the battlefield. We're using, you know, computer manned drones from the United States to go places. So just thinking about that, is it biblical for Christians to hold some type of just war theory view? And of course, you mentioned Paul and that we are to, you know, it's very clear we're to pray for the governing authorities. We're to obey our governing authorities unless they're doing asking us to do something that goes against God's commands. But again, the doctrine seems to have to evolve a little bit with accommodating things, like I just mentioned, drone warfare. But still, is it biblical for Christians to have some kind of just war theory versus complete pacifism? As I mentioned, some Christian traditions just reject war altogether.
I do think it's beneficial for Christians to hold to some kind of just war tradition, even if that doctrine seems to change slightly. As I said, this stuff is in the warp and woof of reality. It's not something you get away from. You know, I don't know that we'll ever see, at least in this lifetime, a war on the scale of, you know, what happened in the 20th century. But I mean, you know, there are conflicts, armed conflicts that seemingly go on all the time. It's just part of the warp and woof of how things are, and you can't get away from it. So having a framework, a grid for thinking about those kinds of things as a Christian is fairly important. And history has shown us time and again a strong Christian tradition in this area of study. And I think it certainly would benefit any kind of ethical discussion on something as serious of a topic as ethical warfare, to have the input of the theological system that I think is certainly more justifiable than others. So yeah, I think Christians should, who are interested in thinking through these things, should develop some kind of understanding of a just war theory and the ethics of warfare. And, you know, to just to put a fine point on this of where this sort of all coalesces and meets, the mandate to submit to a governing authority, well, when you sign up for a draft, you know, you do so with the knowledge that in the event of a war like we saw in the 20th century, there's a very good chance your country's going to more or less say you got to go. At that point, you have some decisions you have to make. At that point, you have to have an ethical framework of submitting to your authority means going to war. How you navigate that in your thinking and your convictions is pretty important. And I think it makes a good case for why a Christian should have some kind of just war doctrine at the very least.
Well, I think even if you're not a Star Wars fan per se, I think you can enjoy Andor and get something out of it, because while it's not standalone, it possibly could be. It's going to be, I believe, is it going to be 2 seasons, I think?
My understanding is that it was 2 seasons of 24 episodes planned.
Yes. Yeah, so it could be that that's where it ends, because there's, you know, it's just a lot behind the scenes to commit to more than that. But I do think people could watch this as a standalone. And because it doesn't, you know, if you're not a sci-fi person, you could take this out of the sci-fi realm. There is elements of that, of course, with all the ships and different planets and things like that. But it really doesn't have that. If you didn't, were kind of put off by the Jedi and things like that, it doesn't really have that in here. And there is so much to think about. You know, how would Christians move and live if society suddenly became very hostile to them, to the point of again, imprisoning people and things like that? And it's not unlike some things that we face. Now, we might not face things that are just real and physical, like a war, but there's certain potentially, you know, societal things that we could suffer based on our own convictions. So it is a lot of food for thought in this series, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Andor is a show that if you didn't know it was Star Wars, you would be forgiven for assuming that it's not, for assuming that it's its own thing. But it does feature some nice tie-ins, and I guess what you might call fan service in certain capacities, but it's not overt, and it's certainly not done with the kind of gaudy reverence that a lot of other Star Wars properties have for the source material. But I think it's quite exciting. It's a way of doing Star Wars very differently from anything we've seen before. It's a way of doing Star Wars without Jedi and lightsabers that is not subversive so much as it is just different. It's just different. And in this case, different is not a bad thing.
Well, finally, a fun rapid-fire question for Cole. Speaking about war and things like that, the military, is there anybody in your family that is a military officer or served in a particular war?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had had several. I had some uncles who were actually in World War II. I had one who was at Normandy. I have a grandfather who's a Korea veteran. So I've kind of been told at different points that I know too many people and I'm friends with too many people in the military to have not gone into the military. And I considered it at length actually, several times. It just wasn't in the cards, I guess.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 318 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett, who has written an online exclusive television series review of the Disney Plus Star Wars series Andor. Cole's article is called An Occasion for Just War. Our subscribers can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. If you don't already subscribe, one of the benefits is you get access to all of our online exclusive articles. Head on over to equip.org to subscribe. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.